And in particularly, I'll tell you at some point about the Lanczos method. This sort of goes along with linear algebra, and usually I would do linear algebra first, but we're going to do it the other way around. So I'll tell you about eigenvalues problem first, and then I'll mention some things about linear algebra that is quite useful tomorrow. So, and then we're on to Monte Carlo methods. So today we're going to look at eigensystems, and I should mention that some of what I'll be saying is covered in Pang in chapter 5, right? So I just want to remind everybody of something rather trivial. What we want to solve is basically equations like this one. And my usual notation is two bars under a matrix and then one bar under a vector. Okay, so obviously I can sort of move this here around, and then I end with A minus lambda I here of X that's equal to 0. Okay, so then if we suppose here that the inverse of this exists, what's the solution to that equation? Yeah, the determinant will come in shortly. But if I suppose here that this exists, what's the solution to that equation? Yes, right? So if this one exists, then x here, well, it's just this here applied to the vector 0. And that's equal to 0. Right? I mean, we're starting the lecture. I'm trying to. Now you got all indigestion from looking at the QED rules for, or Feynman rules for QED, right? And okay, so obviously, when we look for eigenvectors and eigensystems or and eigenvalues, then we always require that the vector is different from 0, right? So we don't want this. And that means that if we want solutions to this equation for vectors that are different from 0, then basically we need the determinant here to be 0, or in other words, that the inverse of this matrix, it doesn't exist. So that means that we must require here that the determinant, and my symbol for the determinant is sometimes a delta, sometimes it's something else, but so we have to require that this here is equal to 0, right? OK. The thing that one often forgets is that if I require that this determinant here is equal to 0, it means that the system of equations, the underlying system of equations, is degenerate, right? And that means that roughly we have one less, or maybe even more, equations than unknowns. Right, And that means that we can't, if we compare to solving equation that we'll be talking about probably tomorrow, where we have something of this form, then the eigenvectors, we can only determine them up to a constant, whereas here we would be looking at a unique solution. So there are many ways of then trying to find these eigenvectors and eigenvalues. And I'm going to tell you about probably the most basic in my mind. And sometimes it's left out, but it'll come in and it'll be rather important when we discuss the Lanczos method later, probably tomorrow. So it's just called the power method. So we suppose here that A is an n by n matrix. And roughly everything that I'll be saying applies to real symmetric matrices. So in physics, you know, most problems are going to be Hermitian. So I'll assume, unless otherwise I state otherwise, that A here is real symmetric. Okay. So we assume here that the eigenvalues, they satisfy lambda 1 here is bigger than lambda 2, and that might be bigger than or equal to lambda 3, and so forth, and that might be bigger than or equal to lambda n. So since the matrix here is real symmetric, then I know that we have a basis of eigenvectors. And that basis, I'll call it x1 up to xn. And the corresponding eigenvalues are lambda 1 up to lambda n, right? So that would mean that if I take a random vector, y here, then I can expand it over the eigenvectors. So of course, I can write that y here, it's b1 x1 plus b2 x2 down to bn xn. And so what we want to do then is apply a to y. Because that now becomes exceedingly simple because I've decomposed it here on the eigenvectors. So I would get b1 lambda 1 x1 plus b2 lambda 2 x2 and so forth bn lambda n xn. Since this method here is called the power method, it probably implies that I'm going to do this more than once. So I look at this, and then I say to myself, well, if I do that many times, then I'm just going to pull out these lambdas to some power n. And then I can pull out the first one here. So I would get lambda 1 to the power n. And then I get b1 x1. And then here I would get lambda 2 over lambda 1 to the power n, b2 x2, and so forth. And the last one would be lambda 1 or lambda n over lambda 1, and then bn xn. Right? So since I somehow assumed that there was an extremal eigenvalue here, then, wow, then we can hope that this here would go to zero relatively quickly. And basically, with this assumption, eventually, if I can crank out the, this to a high enough order, this is actually a basis of many projection techniques that I won't tell you about, but quite often you employ techniques like this where you're assuming that terms that you don't want eventually will disappear. Okay, can anybody see some problems with just using this all the time? Yeah?
So we could get unlucky and choose, well, so if we are unlucky, we can choose V1 small enough compared to everything else that the biggest one doesn't pop out, and the fewer iterations we do, the more likely we are to be unlucky.
Well, the it's always going to be a problem here if V1 happens to be zero, and that's why in techniques like this, and eventually when we'll talk about Lanczos, Lanczos is built on, in sort of my way of talking about Lanczos, is that it's built on top of the power method. So you always start with a random vector. And that's rather important because you assume that your random vector will have an overlap with all the eigenvectors. But you're entirely right if you're unlucky enough that B1 here maybe is not zero, so you haven't taken something that's orthogonal to the state that you want, but it could just be rather small, then things could become sluggish. So that's a problem. The other thing I want to note here is that you can see that the way we're approaching the problem here might be different from what you've seen before, because we're not trying to get, or at least not yet, trying to get all the eigenvalues. We're focusing on the extremal eigenvalues. So if you write down a matrix problem or a matrix for your quantum mechanical problem, then typically the ground state would correspond to an extremal eigenvalue. So this here, given that we take B1 here, so that's non-zero by choosing a random vector, and then more importantly, so that we hope that lambda 1 here, it's quite a big, bigger than lambda 2. So obviously, we want this term here to go to 0 fast. But if it turns out that the second value is very close to the one we want, then, well, this is going to go to 0 rather slowly. So when we look at the power method here and other iterative techniques for finding extremal eigenvalues, then if things start to slow down, if the convergence suddenly becomes very sluggish, it's usually a sign here that you have an eigenvalue that's close to the extremal one. So there's a physical underlying physical reason that if this happens, because the gap that you have in the system becomes relatively small. Okay, so I just want to. This is actually a useful method. Sometimes you can just crank this out. It has a great advantage that you can write it in just a few lines. So. Let's do some code here, and when I write it, then you know, it's what I would call a pseudo code here. So I would say that maybe we want to do K-max iterations. And then what we could do is that we said y here equal to ax, right? And then I take one on my first estimate for lambda. Well, it would be the norm of y here divided by the norm of x, right? And then you can see I have this power sitting out here. And if lambda 1 happens to be 100, and we start taking that to a power, then that could become very big. So let's shift everything back. So my new x here, I simply take it to y here and then divide it by the norm of y. And so n do here. So if I count the two lines for my do loop, I would say that you could write this program in probably about 5 lines, right? So I can print this out then, because after k max, which is the point where I got tired, when I'm done here, then my best estimate of lambda is going to be the last one. And my best estimate of basically x1 here, that's going to be what's sitting in x at that point. OK, so what you can see here is that I can also do what's called an inverse power method, which sounds fancy, but really isn't that fancy. So if we assume that the inverse of A here, it exists, and that the well, if we have eigenvalues here of A, then well, it would mean here that x here is equal to A minus 1 lambda x here. And so I can divide this over. So that, of course, means that A minus 1 x here is 1 over lambda times x. So if I didn't want to have the largest eigenvalue, but instead the one that's the smallest in absolute values, then I could so I could use the power method with A minus 1.
Everything else.
I haven't told you about that, and I'll do that in 2 okay. seconds. So, quite often, so this would get a, give us the extremal one. Then here, I could look at this, and I could run it, and I could get the smallest one. You could say, well, this sounds not very clever, because I would have to actually invert the matrix, which could be complicated. But typically, we would want something where xk plus 1 here is equal to a xk, where this is the inverse. But what I can do here is that I can just shift it over and say, well, I'm looking for an xk plus 1 that satisfy this equation then. And this I can solve with linear algebra. So you don't explicitly calculate the inverse. If you're looking for an eigenvalue which is not either the smallest one or the largest one, then you can also go ahead and I can just take the matrix and then subtract mu times I from it. So the other thing here I can do is, I can shift. So I take A here and then I replace it with A minus something like this. And that would likely allow me to study the extremal eigenvalues around the point mu in the spectrum. So if you look in at various libraries and Lanczos methods, they will typically tell you something like an inverse iteration here, or you can shift your spectrum, and sometimes you have to actually apply the or supply the constants that you have to input there. So there are various number of tricks here that you can apply, and it's not very profound what you're doing. You're just taking the actual matrix and then shifting its spectrum so that the eigenvalues that you want are the extremal ones. But as Dennis is saying, what would happen if I had found this one, if I had found lambda 1 and x1, and I wanted x2 and lambda 2? So one thing you could do, even though it may be cumbersome, I could go in and I could say, if lambda 1, x1 here are known, then we study a prime here, which is A. And then minus lambda 1. Let me see if I can write this correctly. X1 here, X1. Right. Because if I look now at A prime here and I apply it to X1, well, it would be A and then minus, or it would be A, X1, and then minus lambda 1, X1, and that would just give us 0. Yes, well, this is my way of writing a matrix, right? This is not a scalar, right?
Okay, so
no. But it will...
Yeah,
well, whatever you want to call it. what it means is that when I apply x1 here, then I apply it to that, and I just get 1, right? Because it's a normalized eigenvector. In other words, what I mean by this is that I just subtract off the projection onto that eigenspace. And then, of course, if this actually works and I get lambda 2, then I could continue this little game, but it sort of starts to sound rather cumbersome. And you can see that it would require manual intervention, because I would have to use this and determine these two to as high a precision that I can, and then stick it in there, right? So I'm just mentioning that you could get this idea. And what I'll say here is that the Lanczos algorithm that we'll probably talk about tomorrow improves considerably in this. So the other thing that you can try to do here is based on what's called similarity transformations. And it's somewhat more involved than the simple power method that we just discussed here. So suppose we look at C here, and that's TA P minus 1 here. And again, A here is real and symmetric. Then I wanna show that A and C here, they have the same eigenvalues. So let's see if we can figure that out, right? So if I look at AX here equal to lambda X, then I can put a T here, and I can put a T there. And then what we want to do is then what we call X here, I set that equal to T minus 1 applied to another vector, Y here. So that would mean then that TA T minus 1 on Y here, it's equal to basically T lambda T minus 1 Y here, and that's equal to lambda Y, right? Okay. And this is, of course, then C on Y here is equal to lambda Y. And again, these are all matrices, right? So I can do this, and probably here I've, of course, assumed that T can be inverted, and there's nothing funny with it. So to a certain extent, we can think about this as a change of basis. So T here is invertible. So you get then the clever idea to look at what is called orthogonal transformations. Right. So we look here at orthogonal transformations. And they're the subclass of these transformations where the inverse is simply given by the transpose. Right? And what do you remember about so it's Monday, right? It is Monday today, right? So it's it's time for a story. It doesn't particularly have anything to do with eigenvalues, but it has something to do with this equation, so that's it's a good enough excuse for me. This is from a book by Forman Acton, who is a Princeton professor and one of the original tough guys with pocket protector and everything. He has written a wonderful book that's called Numerical Methods That Work. And then if you get the book, I should have brought it. It's written in very fine and almost unreadable print, usually between the word that and work. So anyway, so he has this story here. It was 1949 in Southern California. Our computer was a very new CPC model 1, number 1, a 1 second per arithmetic operation clunker that was holding the computational Ford while an early electronic monster was being coaxed to life in an adjacent room, right? So you can see one flop per second, right? So from a nearby aircraft company, which remains unnamed for this story, there arrived one day a 16 by 16 matrix of 10-digit numbers whose inverse was desired. We really had asked for it. Our matrix inversion routine was new and barely tested, and the CPC represented a tremendous, if as yet unrealized, increase in computing capacity over a room full of girls with desk calculators. We had offered to demonstrate our prowess, and in walked this matrix, right? A 16 by 16 matrix, and this was cutting edge in 1949, right? We labored for 2 days. And after the usual number of glitches that accompany any strange procedure involving repeated handling of intermediate decks of data cards, right? So this was all punch cards, right? We were possessed of an inverse matrix. During the checking operations, which involved the multiplication of the inverse by the original, right? Sounds like a good check. It was noted that to 8 significant figures, the inverse was the transpose of the original. A hurried visit to the aircraft company to explore the source of the matrix revealed that each element had laboriously been hand-computed from some rather simple combinations of sines and cosines of a common angle. It took about 10 minutes to prove that the matrix was indeed orthogonal. So. Right. So that I always wanted. I wanted to know if that was a huge aircraft corporation that did this. But anyway, so. That 2 days of work, right, for a 16 by 16 matrix, and probably this was a whole team of people, right? So we want to look at this, and what we're going to do is something that we'll be doing many times here. We're just going to take sort of the simplest thing we can do here, and that's this one. So it's a matrix which is almost the identity matrix here, but some things occur along the diagonal, which is not equal to 1. And then correspondingly here, I put an S, and here I put a minus S. And this column here is called P, and that is called Q, and then this here is correspondingly the row that are called P and Q. And again, just to make everything clear, when I'm not writing something, it's assumed to be equal to 0. So if I want here this to be true, then C squared plus S squared here is equal, or it has to be equal to 1. And that, of course, right, means that probably when I write C, then it's a cosine, and this here would be the sine of some angle. So actually, what we're doing here is that we're taking just 2 of the underlying basis vectors. So whenever we have a matrix A here written, it's of course always written with respect to some basis of Rn, right? And of course, in Rn, then it's usually the simplest basis that we can think of. But what this year orthogonal transformation would do for us is it's going to take two of these vectors, and then it'll rotate them slightly, right? And then, of course, I'm going to take a whole number of these orthogonal transformation, and I'm going to take another pair, and I'm going to rotate it, right? And eventually, I'm going to be rotating the basis of my entire system sort of back and forth until I happen upon the basis which corresponds to the eigenvectors of the matrix A, right? So that's the name of the game. We're just going to figure out a way to determine C and S here so that this makes sense. So we have to analyze what's happening here. So the way I think about this is that I have my matrix for the transformation, which looks something like this. Right? And then I apply that to my matrix A. Okay? What will happen is that it's going to take A here and form a new new matrix that I call A prime. And that new matrix will have row P and row Q replaced by linear combinations, right? Okay. So obviously, the next thing we want to do here is I'm going to take A prime, and then I'm going to take the inverse, which is just the transpose of that matrix. So I'll get a C S minus S C, and so forth. And when I apply that to A prime, I'm going to end up with a matrix, and I don't want to give the, so let's assume that it's something like this. Going to end up with a matrix here where two lines and two columns have been modified. And actually, they've been modified in a very simple way, because all that happens is that we replace a line with a linear combination of the two lines, right? So how can we use this for something useful? Well, the first thing I want to do is that I want to say that this rotation here, I can write it in four lines in Fortran, right? So let's see if we can figure that out. Well, I would have some A prime here, and I write that the pth row here, it would be equal to C times the pth row in the original matrix, and then minus S times the qth row, right? And then I can do the same thing with the qth row. So I claim that it's S times the pth row, and then plus C times the qth row. So we're exploiting the fact here that Fortran can do operations on entire rows and columns simply by us putting in a colon sign here. It means that it's supposed to be done on the entire row in this case, right? And there are no needs to write complicated do loops. Then I want to get to this matrix here, which I'm going to call A double prime. So A double prime Well, all it does is I'm now going to have to find some new columns. And, well, what we have to do is that we have to modify the Qth column and the Pth column. And we can just read off how it should work. But I always get the sign wrong here. So I'm just going to read it off my notes here. OK. So this here's S, and then A prime, the P here, and then plus C, A prime, Q, right? You can see here we form a linear combination of rows, and here we form linear combination of lines, right? No, columns, right? OK, so you're cool with the fact that we can. Now we have to be a little bit careful, because probably we need more than just these four lines. But the remaining lines will just be rather simple-minded, and assuming that we don't override and things like that. Right? So what we're going to do here is we're going to do a strategy. And for the moment, it's not clear why that's a good strategy, but I'll prove that that's a brilliant strategy in a few seconds. So our strategy here is we want to set APQ here in the transformed matrix, in other words, this one. And of course, since the matrix is symmetric, then and for the moment actually also real, then these are related. And what we're going to try to do is that we're going to try to set that equal to 0. OK. And then the rest of the algorithm, which I'll talk about in 2 seconds, is then sort of just figuring out a way of going through the matrix and locating elements that are off the diagonal and trying to set them equal to 0. But what we need here is if we decide to set this equal to 0, then we need to use this to determine eventually the angle that we rotated the two vectors with. In other words, we need to determine the C and S that went in there, right? So now I just need to do a little bit of footwork. And by the way, I should say that you're going to try this for a tutorial. And the way we're going to do it is the way that is described in a book called The Miracle Recipes by Press, Tucholsky, etc. We're going to try to do it with these Fortran statements. And I believe we're going to produce a little handout. So I'm going to have some indices here, and likely I'll get one of the indices wrong. But you can find the final result on the handout, right? So this is not what I want here. So yeah, it actually is, right? So I basically just need to go and have a look at what AP double prime Q is. But I can read it off from here. Because it's equal to C A P P prime, and then the wrong line here. It's S A prime P P, and then plus C A P Q prime. Right. Just this line here, right? OK, and then I can just go in, and I can go up here in the two lines above, and I can read off what A prime PP and A prime PQ is. So this is C times APP minus SAQP plus C times C APQ minus SAQQ. And if I move around with this, then I get SC here, APP minus AQQ, and then plus C squared here, and then minus S squared AQP. Okay, so we want to set this equal to 0. So if this here is supposed to be equal to 0, then these two things, they have to be the same. So that would mean that C squared minus S squared AQP here, it should be equal to SC AQQ minus APP. Then these would cancel. Okay? So if we want to get at C and S here, then we would see that C squared minus S squared, and then divided by SC here, it's equal to AQQ minus APP, and then over AQP. So for reasons that has to do with using trigonometric relations, it actually turns out to be an advantage of putting in the 2 here, because if this equation is satisfied, if I divide by 2 on either side, then that's fine. Shouldn't be a problem here. And then I just need to... So this is known, right? I know the elements in my original matrix. That should determine alpha, and then I just have to solve for C and S. And of course, we have to remember that C and S are related, since they're just a sine and a cosine. So this can be done. So if I look at this equation here, then I have 2 alpha. SC here, and then plus S squared minus C squared here. That's equal to 0, right? I just decide to divide through with cosine squared. So then I get 2 alpha T here, and then I get plus a T squared, and then I get a minus 1 is equal to 0. So I can then determine the tangent to the angle, right? So T here is just S over C. So then we have reduced everything to solving a second-order equation. But we did that, I think, in the very first lecture, or maybe the second. So you know that we should worry about these second-order equations, and we perhaps should try to avoid cancellations and so forth. So at this point, I can write it as minus alpha and then plus minus the square root of alpha squared plus 1, right? So now experience shows that numerically it's better to take the smallest angle. And that's actually sort of a general rule. If you're doing something that involves a repeated number of operations, try to make these repeated number of operations as small as possible, right? And so what we're doing here is that we're doing some rotations in a complicated manner. And it sounds reasonable that we should try not to rotate by 360 degrees, but try to keep that angle as small as possible. And that would mean that I should try to take the smallest root here, right? And so if alpha happens to be less than 0, then it would be minus alpha, so that would be a positive number, and then minus this. If alpha is bigger than 0, then I would do minus alpha, that would be a negative number, and then plus that. Okay? So that can actually be written, because you can see here, remember that we should try to avoid cancellations like this. So I can combine these, and then I can write them as the sine of alpha here, and then divide it by the absolute value of alpha, and then plus the root of alpha squared plus 1. And again, largely, this formulation here is just to avoid cancellation errors, which we know is probably going to be problematic because we opted for looking at the smallest root. So that will give us t. And once I have t, then I can get C here, which is just this, and then S here, which is T times C, right? So that's the three relations, and really the only thing, the only one that matters is this one, and I just erased our expression for alpha. But alpha was a very simple combination for of the elements in the original matrix. What we want to do is if I look at a practical implementation, then I would look at whatever is above the diagonal. So I would perhaps look at this element, and then I would try to set that equal to 0. And then I would look at the next element here and try to set that equal to 0. And then I would work my way out here. And in doing so, then I've also tried to set this column to 0 because it's a real symmetric matrix. And then I would go to the line below it, and so forth. So this would be one sweep of the off-diagonal elements. Unfortunately, this doesn't solve the problem, because if I'm rotating, if I set this one equal to 0, and then in the next step I try to set that one equal to 0, then this could become non-zero. So we need more than one sweep. And then that, of course, would mean that we would have some criterion for determining when we're done here, and that is actually not very hard to do, and I would encourage you to think about that once I've said a few more words. But for practical purposes, it turns out that even 5 or 6 sweeps here through the off-diagonal elements will usually do the problem. What we're going to do for the tutorial is that we're just going to make a decision and say we do 10 sweeps. And if you like this method, and I actually like this very much, it's an incredibly stable routine, and it has the additional advantage that it never fails. Yes?
So this method is applicable only to real symmetric matrices.
I'll talk about that later as well. For the moment, yeah, it's real symmetric. Just you see the idea? We take one element, try to set it equal to zero, and then we sweep through. If you want to sweep through in sort of a diagonal way, then you know, all power to you. There's nothing particularly with that. But when we're done with a sweep, we're not completely done, so we try to do a fixed number of sweeps, right? There's always a question from someone which asks me, well, you know, this is a routine that's in a great many libraries, and that's of course true. However, I claim that you can implement it in a few lines, and it's sort of a very instructive way of looking at how these things would work. So we want to look at the convergence, and well, so. If I look here at RAP double prime and RAQ double prime, well, then you can go back and look at your notes or what was on the blackboard before. And you can see that it's C times ARP and then minus S times ARQ here, and then S ARP plus CARQ. If R is different from P, then R is different from Q. That's just the fact here that the transformed matrix, it looked like this. And if we're not at this point, that point, or that point, then all we're doing is that we're just taking a linear combination of two lines or two columns. So the expressions are basically this simple. So what we then look at is the ARP squared here. And it would be C squared ARP squared and then plus S squared ARQ squared and then actually minus 2SC ARP, ARQ, and ARQ double prime squared here, it would be S squared, ARP squared, plus C squared, ARQ squared, and then plus 2SC, ARP, ARQ. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is that I'm going to add these two, right? So that would mean that ARP double prime squared plus ARQ double prime squared. Well, it's just ARP squared plus ARQ squared. And again, under the conditions that R is different from P and R is different from Q. So why is this interesting? Well, it's interesting because I can look at S here, which is the sum over all elements that are not on the diagonal, right? And I can then look at the sum of these elements after the transformation, and I would claim that we can call this S prime. So it would be this, And then I can just go over and read off what it is here. So it would be exactly, well, the case here where R is equal to P or R is equal to Q, that would correspond to the diagonal, but we're explicitly neglecting that in this sum over the off-diagonal element here. That won't apply, and the only thing that can occur here is that we will be looking and summing over that element, but that's the one that we chose to set equal to 0. So I would claim here that this is equal to a sum of R different from S of the original elements, and then minus 2 PQ squared. Right? So this is really neat because if I look at the sum of the absolute value squared of the off-diagonal elements, after each single rotation, it decreases by twice the absolute value squared. Right? So in other words, this is a guaranteed convergence. And of course, if you want to get really fancy, you can use array manipulation techniques in Fortran to single out the biggest element sitting off diagonally, and you can use to target that if you don't want to sweep and so forth, but we're not going to talk about that. So Jacobi's method here, as it's called, that will guarantee a convergence, and that's why we can usually make do with iterating 10 times. So the last remaining thing that we need So what about the eigenvectors? At the end, what we will have done is something like this, T3, T2, T1, and then I have this. So when I'm done here, then I'll have a matrix which will be almost diagonal, and we can just go in and read off the eigenvalues by looking at the diagonal. Of course, I want to say that they could occur in whatever order. There's no reason that they should come out to be ordered when we're done. But this is the general idea. Then I want to say, well, I can look at this as one big matrix, and maybe we want to call that OT here, and then A, and then maybe I want to call that O here, right? And then the only way to interpret this is that O has columns that are eigenvectors of A, right? So O here, that would be sort of our x1, x2, and xn. And they'll correspond to the eigenvalue that we have sitting on the diagonal there, right? So if we want to get the eigenvectors as well, we just have to keep track of this product. But you can see that that's hardly any work, because whenever we're multiplying or rotating the matrix, we've already written the code for doing that step here, right? So we can keep track of this by taking the identity matrix and then applying first T1 minus, or the inverse of T1 to it, then the inverse of T2, and then the inverse of the last one. Okay, so the and doing this step here, we already wrote the Fortran code for doing that. So all we have to do is that we do half the rotation on the identity matrix, and the end of the day, that will just be a matrix then composed of the eigenvectors. So this is very neat. We get all the eigenvalues and all the eigenvectors. Unfortunately, this here is O of n 3. So it's cubic in the size of the matrix. For an n by n matrix. So this is not something that you would be using on very large matrices, and hence the interest in looking at Langsdorff methods and power methods and so forth. Is it clear roughly how this works? Yuck. I hope that was from last week. Oh, be bad. So the only thing I want to say here is that what I talked about so far required that we had a real symmetric matrix. Of course, we can just use that now for diagonalizing a complex matrix. Obviously, you can. So let's see how that could be done. So suppose I have a matrix which is now Hermitian. So that would mean that C here would be equal to A plus IB, right? And the fact that it's a Hermitian matrix here, it would imply that A is real symmetric and B is anti-symmetric, right? Okay. So when we look at our eigenvalue equation, it would be something like this. And then I apply it to a vector, which could have a real and a complex part here. And that would be equal to lambda, and then times the vector. OK. So what we're going to do now is I'm just going to multiply through here. So I would get A applied to U. Then I would get plus IB U. And then I would get plus IAB here. And then I would get minus B times B. Right? I think I did that right. And this has to be equal to lambda U plus I lambda B. So since real and imaginary parts have to match up, right, it means that I have something where I have A, U here, and then minus B, V, and then B, U, P, plus AB here. That's equal to lambda U here, and this is equal to lambda V. Okay. In other words, if I write this out, I have a matrix which is now 2n by 2n, which is A and then minus B and B and A here, and then U and V. And that would be equal to lambda U and V. So if I want to take a matrix that works on a real symmetric one and use it for diagonalizing a Hermitian matrix, then that can actually be done rather simply, because you can see that this here is now real symmetric. You could say, well, it's kind of bad because I now have a 2n by 2n matrix, but it's not all bad because if I had written an algorithm that would treat complex matrices directly, I would still have to work with the imaginary and real parts. So there's just one little thing here, and that's the fact that a 2n by 2n matrix like this one, that of course has 2n eigenvalues, and our original problem should only have n of them. So it's very easy to see here, if uv here is an eigenvector, then so is minus v over u. So all eigenvalues occur twice. Questions at this point? Sometimes you actually do this. You just feed it into your favorite Hermitian or real symmetric routine, and everything works. So for the tutorial, you're going to try to write the little rotation in the Jacobi routine, and it should actually work. And you can diagonalize and get all the eigenvalues and all the eigenvectors. And then tomorrow we'll talk about, so the important thing here to remember is that this is n cubed here. Actually, I had a note in saying that it's usually 12 to 20 here, and then times n cubed. So it's expensive. I don't know anybody who would take a matrix that's larger than, say, maybe 5,000 by 5,000 and try to use what is called, so this here is often called a dense algorithm. Largely because Lanczos is called a sparse method, then we have one that's dense here. It has the great virtue of giving you all the eigenvectors and all the eigenvalues, but it's costly. Okay, I'm not going to say anything more today. Let's go have lunch. No more. It's all clear.